Thank you. And now, Pastor Comparé.
Thank you. Today, I want to talk about what Jeremiah planted. One of the greatest figures in history is the prophet Jeremiah. In Jeremiah 1, verse 10, God commissioned him to carry out a double task, saying, "See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms, to root out and to pull down and to destroy and to throw down, and to build and to plant." His rooting out and throwing down was completed when Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian army finished the deportation of the kingdom of Judah to Babylon, its last traces being thrown down when the murder of Governor Gedaliah was followed by the flight of the survivors to Egypt, compelling Jeremiah to accompany them, despite his warnings against this. But what and where did he build and plant? Historically, the Bible does not tell us, as it last mentions him at Tapanhes in Egypt. Just as Jeremiah in Jerusalem had warned the people of Judah not to rebel against Babylon, so had Ezekiel at Babylon given the same warning, giving the parable of a great eagle which cropped off from the top twigs of the cedar tree, an emblem of Judah's royal family, carried it to Babylon and planted it, where it became a low vine. But another eagle came along and the vine grew toward him. Ezekiel says the first eagle is Nebuchadnezzar, and the second is Pharaoh of Egypt, and warns of punishment for breaking the covenant to be a vassal of Babylon. Then, in contrast to what the eagles have done, God says what he will do. "Thus says the Lord God, I also will take of the highest branch of the high cedar, and I will set it. I will crop off from the top of his young twigs a tender one, and will plant it upon a high mountain and eminent. In the mountain of the height of Israel will I plant it, and it shall bring forth boughs and bear fruit, and be a goodly cedar, and under it shall dwell all fowl of every wing. In the shadow of the branches thereof shall they dwell." That's Ezekiel 17, verses 22 and 23. Feminine words are used for young twigs, a tender one, though masculine words would have served as well. Nebuchadnezzar killed all the sons of the king of Judah, thinking this destroyed the royal family. But as Numbers 27, verse 8 shows, under Israel law, when there were no sons, the inheritance went to the daughters. The 43rd and 44th chapters of Jeremiah record that he, with his scribe Baruch and the king's daughters, were taken by the remnant of the people to Tapanhes in Egypt. There he warned them that they were all doomed except such as could possibly escape from Egypt. This escape is the only possible fulfillment of God's prophecy that Jeremiah would build and plant. Churches which like to call Jeremiah the prophet of doom have created the fable that he died in Egypt, but by this they accuse their God of failure and falsehood, for Jeremiah could only build and plant as God prophesied after leaving Egypt. So let's see what Jeremiah built and planted and where. The king's daughters were the tender twigs which God said he would plant. Where could Jeremiah have taken them? Remember, it must be to a great Israel nation, in the mountain of the height of Israel, said God. He did not take them to Babylon, where the people of Judah were captives, for that would have been recorded also by Ezekiel and Daniel if it had happened. He would not have been allowed to take them through the Babylonian Empire to where the 10 northern tribes of Israel were by this time known as the Scythians. And the record is clear that he did not take them back to the old kingdom of Judah to stay, although he stopped off there long enough to pick up the Ark of the Covenant and Jacob's pillow, the Stone of Destiny, which had been hidden from the Babylonians. Where else were there Israelite kingdoms? In Greece, in Spain, and in Ireland. Historians agree that Greece was barbarous until a high civilization was brought there by settlers who had come from Egypt but were not Egyptians, being aliens expelled by the Egyptians. These are the Danaoi, seafarers of the tribe of Dan, who had left Egypt by sea. The date is approximately that of the exodus of Israel from Egypt. Also near this date, Ireland had been conquered by highly civilized invaders who came by sea. These were the Tuatha De Danann, or tribe of Dan, who ruled Ireland for about 200 years thereafter. Another Hebrew migration from Egypt was that of half of the royal tribe of Judah, and this was before the general exodus. The tribe of Judah consisted of two branches, respectively the descendants of the twins, Perez and of Zerah. The Zerahites were men of great ability, even Solomon being compared to them in wisdom, but the Perez branch were considered the older, hence entitled to preference as the royal line. So the Zerahites sought other lands where their ability might seek its own level. They settled in Crete. They also founded the cities of Troy and Miletus in Asia Minor. After the fall of Troy, somewhere near 1000 B.C., Brutus the Trojan and his followers went to England, where they founded what became the city of London. This is well-established history. The city of Miletus became a great power and a great colonizer. Milesian coins bore the Lion of Judah. Milesian mercenary troops were hired by Egypt as its chief border guards. And Milesians from the colony in Spain, with a considerable fleet and army, conquered the Tuatha De Danann and settled in Ireland, where Milesian civilization lasted as long as Ireland remained independent. Their language was Phoenician, which is a Semitic dialect akin to Hebrew, and it became the Gaelic language of ancient Ireland and Scotland, which even today is nearly identical with Phoenician. The Irish chronicles also record that the Milesians introduced the laws of Moses, which remained Irish law until the time of St. Patrick. Ancient Irish history records that about 583 B.C., there came to Ireland from Egypt Olam Fodla, which means the great prophet. With him were Brug, his scribe, and Tea Tethi, the daughter of a king. Irish tradition has always identified Olam Fodla as the prophet Jeremiah, and his scribe, Brug, is of course Baruch, who was mentioned in the Bible as Jeremiah's scribe. Near Jeremiah's tomb in Ireland is a stone inscribed with hieroglyphics which show a star formation, which was in that exact form about 583 B.C., which was the time of Jeremiah's migration from Egypt. While the Bible records the capture of the Ark of the Covenant by the Philistines, it does not mention its capture by Babylon, although it does mention their looting the golden vessels of the temple. Hence, we may be sure that the Ark was safely hidden. In taking the king's daughter on his divinely commanded mission to build and to plant, Jeremiah would naturally try to take along the remaining sacred objects. While there is no positive record of his taking the ark, the Irish chronicles do record his bringing the Stone of Destiny, Jacob's pillow, and from Ireland it is historically traced through Scotland to England, where it is now in the coronation chair in Westminster Abbey. The family of a member of one of our own congregations had their genealogy traced and published, and it records that one of their ancestors came to Ireland with the prophet Jeremiah, this ancestor's duty being that of the custodian of the Stone of Destiny. I might add that this is not mere wishful thinking, for the member of the family who had the genealogy traced and published knew nothing of the identity of the Anglo-Saxon peoples with the Israel of the Bible. The princess Tea Tethi, brought to Ireland by Jeremiah, is undoubtedly the daughter of King Zedekiah of Judah. She was married to Eochaid, the Heraman or chief king of Ireland, who was in the Milesian dynasty and therefore of the Zara branch of the royal tribe of Judah. So the two branches of the royal tribe were now united in the royal family ruling the free half of Judah. As God said to Jeremiah, he would clip off a tender twig from the highest twigs of the great cedar tree of Judah and plant it in the mountain of the height of Israel, which was fulfilled by this royal marriage. Jeremiah was a prophet of doom only to the Palestinian kingdom of Judah, and his prophecies to it were accurate. But this was not the end, for remember, God said, "See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms, to root out and pull down, and to destroy and to throw down, but also to build and to plant." Having finished the rooting out and throwing down, Jeremiah went on to build and to plant in Ireland, where God's people Israel had established a high civilization, just as God himself had prophesied. Today I want to talk about the Stone of Destiny. In the coronation chair in Westminster Abbey in London is an oblong block of sandstone upon which all of England's kings have been crowned for several centuries. And before that, the kings of Scotland, and before them, the kings of Ireland. This is another bit of evidence of the identity of the Anglo-Saxon people as the Israel of the Bible, and that the house of David still rules over them. The history of this stone begins in the 28th chapter of Genesis, where we read that Jacob camped overnight in the field, and for his pillow used a stone with his folded cloak over it. During the night, God appeared to him in a vision and promised to give him the land of Canaan. When Jacob awoke, he said, "This is the house of God," and named the place Bethel, meaning house of God. Then he took the stone he had used as his pillow and set it up as a monument, and dedicated it with an offering of oil. He promised that if God would help him, "Then shall Yahweh be my God, and this stone which I have set for a monument shall be God's house." In Genesis 35, God instructs him to go back to Bethel and set up an altar to God, which Jacob did. It was at this time that God changed Jacob's name to Israel, and Israel again set up and dedicated as a monument of witness the stone pillar which he had dedicated as God's house. Its sacred character was now firmly established. We next find mention of it in Genesis 49, when the aged Israel, before he dies, tells his 12 sons what will befall their respective descendants in the last days. Speaking of Joseph, he says, "From thence is the shepherd of the stone of Israel." We should, therefore, expect to find the stone in the custody of the sons of Joseph in the last days. The English are the tribe of Ephraim, descended from one of Joseph's sons. Its sacred character having been established, the stone would not be thereafter abandoned. We next hear of it when the children of Israel, in their exodus from Egypt, were facing death by thirst in the desert. God instructed Moses, "I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb, and thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, that the people may drink." And thus they were saved from death. This miracle was repeated later, but this time Moses was instructed merely to speak to the rock, not strike it, because Moses disobeyed God and hit the rock in a grandstand play before the people. He was not allowed to enter the promised land. We must not think that this rock was merely the native rock cliffs of these desert places, for in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 to 4, Paul says, "All our fathers were under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." That is, they were given water to drink from a rock which was carried along with them. And as Israel had said, "This stone which I have set up for a monument shall be God's house." So Christ hallowed it with his presence. After Joshua had conquered the promised land and divided it among the 12 tribes, he reminded them they must ever be loyal to God, and he set up a stone as a monument of witness to this warning. The Hebrew says he took the stone of greatness, and what would that be, or what more fitting witness could there be, but the stone which was God's house? Before God ever allowed Israel to have a king, the rebel Abimelech had himself crowned king beside this pillar or monument, as we read in Judges 9, verse 6. Later, when the lawful monarchy was established in the house of David, we find it was the custom that the king be crowned standing by the pillar or monument, where we read in 2 Kings 11, verses 12 to 14, "And he brought forth the king's son, and put the crown upon him, and gave him the testimony. And they made him king, and anointed him, and they clapped their hands, and said, God save the king. And when Athaliah heard the noise of the guard and of the people, she came to the people into the temple of Yahweh. And when she looked, behold, the king stood by a pillar, as the manner was, and the princes and the trumpeters by the king, and all the people of the land rejoiced. The stone had become a sacred relic, a witness of the mutual promises of God and of the children of Israel. It would be found close to the temple and close to the throne. Upon the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar, 2 Maccabees 2, verses 4 to 8 says that ancient records stated that Jeremiah had taken the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle and had hidden them in the cave on Mount Nebo. While 1 Samuel chapters 4 and 5 record the capture of the Ark by the Philistines and its return, there is no mention of it being taken by the Babylonians, so the ancient record of the Ark being hidden must be correct. Along with the Ark, we may be sure that Jeremiah would also safely hide the sacred witness stone, God's house, which had twice been used to give water to the people to save them from death, and which was now used in the coronation of the kings. When I spoke to you on what Jeremiah planted, I told you how Jeremiah and the daughters of the last king of Judah, Zedekiah, were taken to Egypt with the refugees. But in order to fulfill God's prophecy that Jeremiah was also to build and to plant, Jeremiah had to leave Egypt and to take the princess to where another Israelite kingdom was then in existence, in Ireland. We know that with Jeremiah went Baruch, his scribe, and the king's daughter, and with the princess he would also certainly take the hidden stone upon which the kings were crowned. The ancient Irish chronicles record the coming of the great prophet with his scribe, Brug, obviously Baruch, and the daughter of the king, about 583 B.C., which would be the correct date, and that with them they brought the wonderful stone, or stone of destiny. A woman of my acquaintance belongs to a family whose genealogy shows that one of their ancestors came to Ireland with Jeremiah, and that this ancestor's duty was that of custodian of the stone. Teatethi, the king's daughter, married Eochaid, the Heraman, or chief king of Ireland. The stone, called Leah Fail, or Stone of Destiny, was kept at the capital city of Tara for some 3 centuries, and all the kings, descendants of Eochaid and Teatethi, were crowned on it. Then, about 350 B.C., it was sent to Scotland for the coronation of Fergus, king of Scots, who was a descendant of the Milesian kings of Ireland. It remained in Scotland, and all Scottish kings were crowned on it until 1297 A.D., when King Edward I of England invaded Scotland and captured the stone, which he took to England, where it was placed in Westminster Abbey, its home ever since that date. It was built into the coronation chair, which is the oldest piece of furniture in England, still serving its original purpose, and all English kings have been crowned on it ever since. Its origin was well known during the entire time it has been in the British Isles, and from practically the first it was called Jacob's Stone. William of Rislanger, writing in the 13th century, records the coronation of John de Baliol as King of Scotland in the year 1292 upon the stone on which Jacob placed his head. While the 10-tribe nation of Israel had to abide many days without a king, as God prophesied in Hosea 3, verse 4, yet there must always be a royal family of David's line on the throne over some Israelite people. For God promised through Jeremiah 33, verse 17, that David shall never lack a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel. We know that Eochaid the Heraman was in the Milesian line of kings of Ireland, and that the Milesians in Ireland were the descendants of Zara, a son of Judah, and that Teatethi was a descendant of David, who was also of the royal tribe of Judah, through Judah's other son, Phares. So the two royal lines of Judah were united with the marriage of Eochaid and Teatethi, and a descendant of David was always on the throne over Israelite people, as God had promised. The Ark of the Covenant belonged in the temple, and the temple was not to be a continuous institution like the throne of David. So it is not surprising that the Ark has disappeared from history and probably will not be revealed again until Jesus Christ returns to reign upon the throne of David, as is prophesied in Isaiah 9, verse 7. But the throne was to be a continuous throne, as we saw in Jeremiah 33, verse 17. Therefore, it is only logical that the coronation stone, which the Hebrews had called the stone of majesty and the pillar of witness, should be found where the throne of David had its continued existence. After all, it was the pillar of witness, for it had been made witness both to Israel's promise to be Yahweh's people and Yahweh's promise to be their God. It should be there as a witness that Yahweh always makes good his promises and that David shall never lack a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel. The entire Bible, both Old and New Testament, is written about and addressed to a race whom God himself called my people, Israel, who are not and never were Jews. All of God's promises in the Bible were made to Israel. Either God has failed miserably to carry out his promises, or else Israel, his people, is still to be found in the world today, receiving the blessings which God promised to them. If they are here, who are they, and where have they been in the meantime? From the time of the Exodus from Egypt, the people Israel was organized into a nation of 12 tribes, just like the United States of 50 states. After they entered the promised land of Palestine, they continued as this 12-tribe nation until the death of Solomon in 975 B.C. Then they split into two nations, the 10 northern tribes keeping the name Israel, while the two southern tribes took the name Judah. The northern kingdom, Israel, was later conquered by Assyria, and by 715 B.C. they were all deported by the Assyrians from their old Palestinian home and resettled around the southern end of the Caspian Sea. By 713 B.C., the Assyrians invaded Judah also and deported a large part of her population to the same Caspian Sea area. From this time on, Bible history does not trace the further progress of Israel, except that in the Apocrypha, 2 Esdras 13, verses 40 to 45, traces their movement as far as Ar-Serath, the valley of the river Serath, which still bears that name, in Romania. It's a northern tributary of the Danube. But for many centuries after the nation Israel disappeared from Bible history, Bible prophecy still promises the nation a magnificent future, recognizing their continued existence. Not only the Old Testament, but nearly all books in the New Testament are addressed to Israel, as I will show you on this program. Since Israel's Assyrian captivity, under what camouflage have they been hidden from our eyes during these intervening centuries? As you will be shown from time to time on these broadcasts, Israel today can be certainly identified as the group of nations now known as Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Teutonic. How did they forget their old name, move to new lands, and take on new names? We can trace this process through the Bible as well as through history. The entire 43rd chapter of Isaiah, which was written after Israel had disappeared into the Assyrian deportation, deals with redeemed Israel. It opens, "But now, thus saith the Lord that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name. Thou art mine." In verse 18, God commands forgetfulness of their past, saying, "Remember ye not the former things, neither consider the things of old." And in verse 8, "Bring forth the blind to people that have eyes, and the deaf that have ears." Therefore, in the New Testament, in Romans 11, verse 25, Paul tells us that blindness in part has happened to Israel. They did forget their history and identity. God also commanded them to take a new name instead of Israel. In Isaiah 62, verse 2, God says to them, "Thou shalt be called by a new name, which the mouth of the Lord shall name." As the Bible many times declares, God's people Israel are his servants. So in the 65th chapter of Isaiah, God warns the Jews, "Ye shall leave your name for a curse unto my chosen, for the Lord God shall slay thee, and call his servants by another name." In Genesis 21, verse 12, God told Abraham, "In Isaac shall thy seed be called." We say Isaac, but the Hebrew accents the last syllable, Perhaps this is why we have been called Azak's sons, Saxons. But in Numbers 6, verse 27, God said, "They shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them." Accordingly, the name of Christ, Christians, has been put on us, and God has blessed us richly. In Deuteronomy 28, verse 10, God added, "And all the people of the earth shall see that thou art called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of thee." And this was true for centuries, until Christ-hating traitors in our own government have made us despised in the world. While all the 12 tribes were living in Palestine, and King David was on the throne over them, God promised in 2 Samuel 7, verse 10, and 1 Chronicles 17, verse 9, "I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more, as before time." Now this looked to the future. It couldn't be Palestine, both because they were already there, and because they did have to move from there. Hence it prophesied their migration to new lands given them by God. These were left empty, waiting their arrival, according to the promise in Deuteronomy 32, verse 9. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Migrating to their new home, forgetful of their history, their name, and their religion, they were then the lost tribes of Israel. Hence in Jeremiah 50, verse 6, God says, "My people have been lost sheep. Their shepherds have caused them to go astray. They have turned them away on the mountains, and they have gone from mountain to hill. They have forgotten their resting place." In the 34th chapter of Jeremiah, God promises, "So will I seek out my sheep, and will deliver them out of all places where they have been scattered in the cloudy and dark day." In fulfillment of this, Jesus Christ himself declared in Matthew 15, verse 24, "I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel." And he commanded his 12 apostles, "Go not into the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel," adding, "Ye shall not have gone over the cities of Israel till the Son of Man be come." Obviously, this did not refer to Palestine, as they could have covered all of its cities in 3 weeks, but he spoke of Israel and its new lands. In new lands, under a new name, speaking a new language, Israel was hidden, camouflaged, until the time should come to reveal them. But they were not hidden from God, who said in Hosea 5, verse 3, "I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hid from me." But God's enemies have always hated us, both when they knew our identity and while we have been camouflaged. So Psalm 83 says, "Keep not thou silence, O God, hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people, and consulted against thy hidden ones. They have said, Come, and let us cut them off from being a nation." In fulfillment of this, Christ-hating internationalist traitors among us have conspired to cut us off from being a nation, to make us just a conquered province of the United Nations world government. In Isaiah 61, verse 9, God says of us, "And their seed shall be known among the nations, and their offspring among the people. All that see them shall acknowledge them, that they are the seed which the Lord has blessed." So today, all the rest of the world say that we are the have nations, richly blessed by God, while they are the have nots. When will this camouflage be removed? Isaiah's 25th chapter opens with God's promise of protection to us while he destroys the pagan United Nations and then removes our camouflage. Ferrar Fenton's modern English translation of the Bible is the clearest on this. "Then the great Lord will remove on this hill the veil veiling the tribesmen and the covering that covers it from all the heathen. By then it will have served its purpose." Meanwhile, if we would know our identity, read Isaiah 51, verses 1 and 2. "Hearken to me, ye that follow after righteousness, ye that seek the Lord, look unto the rock whence ye were hewn, and to the hole of the pit whence ye are digged. Look unto Abraham your father, and unto Sarah that bore you. That is, ye who follow after righteousness and seek the Lord, look to your ancestry, your racial identity as God's people Israel.
Today, Mr. Comparé will speak on the subject, America is a Bible Land. The Bible is a prophetic book throughout, setting forth his story in advance. Remember the former things of old, for I am Yahweh, and there is none else. I am Yahweh, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. The 46th chapter of Isaiah. Throughout the earthly experience of God's Israel people, he has prepared us for the future by speaking to us through his prophets. If you have listened to your heritage for any period of time and gone to the trouble to verify our documentation, you have satisfied yourself that the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, Scandinavian, Germanic, and kindred peoples are God's Israel people in the earth, the true descendants of the patriarchs, prophets, and apostles of the Bible, and the brethren of Jesus Christ, who is Yahweh in his role as Savior. For the apostasy of our ancestors, Yahweh divorced Israel for a period of seven times or 2,520 years, which was the period in history known as the time of the Gentiles or heathens. During this episode of our history, Israel was taken into captivity by the Assyrians and Babylonians, were deported from Palestine, and hundreds of years before the ministry of Jesus Christ had migrated into Europe, taking on different names and nationalities. They were lost because they had been blinded to their identity and their purpose in God's plan. When you don't know who you are, where you have been, and where you are going, you are lost. However, at all times, the unseen hand of Yahweh was guiding their destiny. They readily accepted Jesus Christ as their long-awaited Messiah and established all the Christian countries of the world, including the greatest Israel nation of them all, the most powerful, productive, and generous nation in history, the United States of America. With Jesus Christ as our King, with our motto, In God We Trust, with our Constitution based upon the Scriptures, our Heavenly Father blessed us to the extent that in the first 100 years of our life as a constitutional republic, with only 5% of the world's population, we amassed more material wealth than the rest of the world had been able to accumulate in all of recorded history. Jesus Christ said, I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly, John 10:10. He also said to the small remnant of the house of Judah who were in Palestine at the time, the kingdom of God shall be taken from you and given to a nation bringing forth the fruits thereof, Matthew 21:43. Is it possible that the United States is that nation? We think so. In any event, since the Bible is his story of the gradual reconcilement of the world to himself through his Israel people, it would indeed be strange if the greatest nation in his story were omitted from the book. It wasn't. Here is Mr. Comparé to tell you about it.
All Christians know that the prophets foretold the future and gave many prophecies which are being fulfilled in our time. But it may be news to many that the Bible even speaks of our own United States of America. Not under that name, of course. But the Bible describes a certain land in such terms as definitely identify it as the United States. However, part of this has been concealed from all but the deepest students of the Bible by the unfortunate mistranslation of certain words in the commonly used King James Version of the Bible. The prophet Isaiah, one of the most deeply inspired prophets in all the Bible, foretells the future of a number of different nations. With one exception, these were kingdoms which were then the important nations and were competing with one another for mastery over Western Asia and the Mediterranean shores. In his 13th chapter, Isaiah names Babylon and foretells its coming destruction, even naming the Medes as the chief nation by whom Babylon would be overthrown, although Isaiah wrote this 176 years before the fall of Babylon. He also foretells that after its destruction, the Arabs would never camp overnight at the site of the ruined city, and this is still true even today. In his 14th chapter, Isaiah concludes his prophecies against Babylon and names another people doomed to be broken as a punishment for their evil ways, the Philistines. In the 15th and 16th chapters, Isaiah prophesies the destruction of another nation, that of Moab. In his 17th chapter, Isaiah foretells the fall of Damascus. Let's skip over the 18th chapter for the moment, but we'll come back to it. In the 19th and 20th chapters, he foretells the destruction of another mighty nation, the great empire of Egypt. And in the 23rd chapter, he foretells the doom of the powerful commercial seaport of Tyre. All these nations were pagan enemies of God's people, and God's patience with their wickedness was near its end. So these prophecies are all prophecies of destruction. Isaiah lists these nations all by name, for they then had names and were the important nations of their day. But in the midst of this, in the short 18th chapter, Isaiah speaks of another nation which he does not name but merely describes it. Unfortunately, the translators have sadly garbled this short chapter until its meaning is lost. Correctly translated from the Hebrew, its references to this unnamed nation, found in verses 1, 2, 3, and 7, read thus, "Ho to the land of buzzing wings, which lies beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, that sends its ambassadors by sea in water-drinking vessels upon the waters. Go, you swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth-shaven, to a people terrible from their beginning onward, a nation measured out by lines underfoot, whose land the rivers divide. At that time shall a present be brought to the Lord of hosts, a people tall and smooth-shaven, a nation measured out by lines underfoot, whose land the rivers quarter, to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, Mount Zion." Now let's examine this very unusual description and see which nation it will fit. It is not named. And as we shall see, this is for the very good reason that at the time when Isaiah wrote, it didn't have any name, because it did not yet exist as a nation. The first strange thing we note is that it's the land of buzzing wings. Nearly all of you who listen to me can, at this very moment, hear the drone of airplanes in the sky. No other nation in the world has its skies so filled with buzzing wings day and night as our own United States. Next, where is it located? Isaiah says it is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. The rivers of Ethiopia are the tributaries which unite into the great river Nile and flow northward into the Mediterranean Sea due west of Jerusalem. Look straight west from Jerusalem, where the prophet wrote these words, and your line of vision will cut across the mouths of the river Nile, across the North African shore, through Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco, none of which can possibly answer any part of the description of this nation. So, we keep on going, due west, across the Atlantic Ocean, and we arrive at the shores of the United States, on the coastline of Georgia and South Carolina. Isaiah says that this nation sends its ambassadors by sea in water-drinking vessels upon the waters. The American ambassadors can go only to Mexico and Canada by land. More than almost any other nation, we must send our ambassadors by sea. And until just the last few years, when we became able to send them on the buzzing wings, by sea they have gone, for most of our history, in water-drinking vessels, that is, steamships, which must drink great quantities of water for their boilers. It is a nation tall and smooth-shaven. You have noticed how few foreigners are of our height. In both world wars, the United States Army was the tallest army on record in all history, and among them were very few mustaches and practically no beards. Today, except for the beatniks, where can you find a beard among us? Again, Isaiah says it is a people terrible from their beginning onward, and so we have been. We were born by defeating the greatest power in Europe, the British Empire, and that not only once but twice. We whipped the North African pirate kings to whom even proud Britain was paying tribute. We ended Spain's long dream of worldwide empire. We won two world wars, which must have gone the other way if we had stayed out. Then, a nation measured out by lines underfoot, says Isaiah. The United States Meets and Bounds Act, enacted by Congress about a century and a half ago, established the world's first system of surveying the whole nation into sections and townships laid out by the compass, which even today most nations do not have. Truly, we are a nation measured out by lines on the ground underfoot. Then, says Isaiah, it is a nation whose land the rivers divide or quarter. The Mississippi River cuts our land in half from north to south. The Ohio River and its tributaries divide the eastern half in two. And the Columbia, the North Platte, and related streams cut the western half in two. Where else do you find any nation like this? Then Isaiah says this, all you inhabitants of the world and you dwellers on the earth, when a banner is raised on the mountains, look in fear and attend when the bugle is blown. Truly, we are a nation terrible from their beginning onward, and when our battle flags fly and the bugles call our armies to war, the whole world has learned it had better pay very respectful attention.